From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As Florida continues to clean up from Irma, we're getting reports of a tragedy today. At least five residents of a nursing home have died, and more than 100 others have been evacuated. The nursing home in the city of Hollywood on the East Coast between Fort Lauderdale and Miami had reportedly been without power since Irma slammed the state on Sunday. NPR's Layla Fadel is in Fort Myers, Florida. She joins us now. Layla, what more do we know about the nursing home deaths?
Well, Broward County confirmed that three people died at the center. Two others died after being taken to the hospital. And they haven't released any information about the exact cause of the deaths. But what we do know is that this hurricane has put basically more than half the state off of power. And people don't have air conditioning in this extreme heat.
Right.
They don't have – and people who are dependent on medical equipment that needs to be plugged in, how do they access that? How do they get that? In some cases, people are staying in hotels with friends who do have power, but not everybody has that option. And so that is the biggest concern going forward. Being dependent on electricity, what do people do?
And we will continue to follow events in Hollywood, but you are in Fort Myers on the West Coast, where a lot of people who were staying in shelters are starting to be able to return to their homes, even if there is some damage and they don't have electricity. Have you been able to go into any people's homes with them, and what are they finding?
Yes, we've been traveling all around this area, Naples, Immokalee, a poor area, Fort Myers. People are returning home. In some cases, they're finding that their homes are severely damaged, especially homes that are more vulnerable, places like mobile homes. We went into one home in Immokalee where the roof was gone, the debris is everywhere, the beds are ruined, all of their home is destroyed. They don't have money left to buy more supplies, and they're dependent on FEMA to help them find a place to stay until they can live somewhere else. Other places still have standing water in the streets, in some cases shin high, in some cases higher. That water is starting to recede, but they're hoping that city officials, county officials are going to start coming in to clear the streets. So people are getting home, not as bad as this is one of the most hard hit areas of this storm, and still homes that are solidly built, concrete poured. A lot of those have been able to stay standing. The biggest issue is the lack of power, and in some cases, the lack of water.
And what about people who have not been able to return home and are still living in shelters? What are you hearing from them?
Well, at this point, they're staying in shelters because they can't get back to their houses. It's as simple as that. And people want as quick a response as possible. They want the power back. They want the water back. Right now, it's doable. A lot of people still have the supplies that they stockpiled from before the storm, especially people who have the means to make those stockpiles. But in a few days from now, is it still going to be doable if they still can't return to their homes? So they're waiting on what response there is going to be. When will the power be back on? And in some cases, some of those homes have been restored.
You mentioned people that have the means or don't have the means. What are you noticing about the difference between how this storm is impacting the poor and people who have more money?
Well, I mean, basically, the storm is a very, very scary situation for everybody, whether they were rich or poor. But in some cases, it can be a very scary inconvenience. And in other cases, it will bankrupt you and destroy your life. We spoke to a woman who makes $800 a month between her and her husband for their household. So that means she had to not pay the water bill in order to be able to get the money to stockpile water and food for her daughter, who's 2 years old, for her father, for her brother, and to get to a motel that was safe enough. And that motel kicked them out because they were running out of water after the storm.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of that, this is a county that has – Collier County is one of the biggest income disparities in the country, the third largest disparity in the country. So on the other side, in Naples, the west side of that county, where they're also dealing with intense power shortages, gas shortages, lack of water, potable water that you can actually drink – this is also a situation where if you have enough money, you can buy the water that you need. You can get the food that you need. You can wait in these long lines for gas. So that is the difference. It can be an inconvenience that's very hard for your family, or it can be a situation where you will likely go into severe debt, run out of money, and possibly not be able to feed your family.
That's NPR national correspondent Layla Fadel joining us from Fort Myers, Florida. Layla, thank you.
Thank you.
Equifax CEO Richard Smith has apologized for the massive data breach that affected 143 million Americans. In an op-ed in USA Today yesterday, Smith said, quote, "We are devoting extraordinary resources to make sure this kind of incident doesn't happen again." But exactly what kind of steps would need to be taken by Equifax or by regulators to ensure that? For more, we're joined now by Rob Weissman. He's president of Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy group, and he joins us from Washington. Hi there, Rob.
It's great to be with you.
All right. So first of all, before we get to sort of future regulatory steps, can you just give us your take on the steps that Equifax has taken already in handling and responding to this enormous data breach?
Handling is a gentle term to describe what they've done. They could not have mismanaged a problem that should have been avoided in the first place any worse if they had tried to.
So like waiting 6 weeks, selling shares, trying to get people to sign up for new services in response, that kind of thing?
Exactly that kind of thing. It's unclear why they waited. It's imaginable that there's some legitimate reason for delaying the information, but it seems highly unlikely. The cost, of course, of delaying telling Americans that their information has been stolen is that they can't act on it if they don't know that it happened. And the hackers may well have been putting the stolen information to bad use. Having taken 6 weeks to reveal the information to the public, you'd think that Equifax would have had in place an excellent system to assist people in dealing with a problem that is entirely of Equifax's making. Instead, the opposite. They seem to view this data breach as a marketing opportunity, a way to lure people into signing up for new services for Equifax that they otherwise wouldn't want and wouldn't need. And impose on them, in the course of doing that, onerous terms that would prevent them from suing the company in the future if it was subject to additional data breaches or other kinds of negligence or misconduct.
Right. I mean, but, you know, in response to outrage, totally legitimate outrage from people, you know, at the very least, they've said they're going to not charge you if you want to freeze your credit. But let me ask you, this is not the first time that Equifax has been hacked, right? I mean, they not that long ago had a hack of people's W-2 information, if I remember correctly. So tragically, the horse is completely out of the barn when it comes to the very sensitive financial and personal information that's out there in the wild now. And it'll be out there for most of us for the rest of our lives, right? So what kind of regulations would you like to see? Like certain requirements for data protection, automatic liability? I mean, tell it to me in more detail.
Well, I don't think it's the case that the horse is all the way out of the barn in the sense that there could still be and there will be future hacks and mass thefts, and that will give new criminals access to our information. So it actually is important that we're proactive in preventing this. And the first question is whether we want to permit the credit companies and others to collect all the data that they do. We don't have to permit that. Other countries do not. But so long as it's happening, the companies have to be forced to protect the data more securely. And when they fail, they should be, as you say, automatically liable. Whether or not our information is ever misused to create a false account or to take a false loan, we've all been imposed upon. We all now have to monitor our credit. We all now have to live with the emotional burden of wondering what the heck is going to happen to us in the future. We should be compensated for that many times over. And if we had a system in place like that, you can be sure that Equifax would do a better job of protecting the data in the first place.
So it's hard to feel any kind of pity or sympathy or generosity to Equifax right now. I will absolutely grant that. But suppose the regulations that you just outlined were put into place. Wouldn't that effectively make it impossible for them to do business?
If they were required to protect the data that they collect without our permission in the first place? No, I think they would do business exactly the same way, except they would actually protect the data.
Well, I'm thinking about the liability piece here, that like if they had to be liable for data breaches that happened, and the reason why I'm asking this is because cyber attacks are going to happen no matter what. That's the world that we're living in right now. I mean, everyone from Yahoo to TJX to Equifax to anybody. Doesn't that make it the risk of doing business almost too great?
No, it doesn't. It means that they have an obligation to protect the information they collect. You know, Equifax is an interesting situation. It's different than, say, a credit card company, you know, or Target or whatever. You go to Target. You voluntarily went to Target. If you gave them information, you gave them information. You enter into a transaction with a credit card company. Okay, you applied for the credit card and you voluntarily did that. With Equifax, you're not a customer of Equifax. Equifax is collecting information on you, whether you like it or not. We didn't enter into any agreement with Equifax to collect our data. They did it as their business model. Okay, if as a society we're going to permit them to do that, then the least they can do is protect the information that they collect, aggregate, and sell. How do we make them do that? Since they evidently don't do it on their own, we put liability rules in place that hold them accountable when they fail to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I should say the credit agencies have been moving in the exact opposite direction. They've been lobbying for rules that would limit their liability, and the entire financial services industry is working desperately hard to eliminate a Consumer Financial Protection Agency rule that would make it possible for wronged consumers to join together in class actions and sue financial wrongdoers. And that's a very hot-button issue that we're going to be facing in the Senate over the course of the next 2 months.
Well, Rob Weissman is president of the nonprofit consumer advocacy group Public Citizen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Residents of the Florida Keys are slowly returning to survey the damage. Yesterday, Federal Emergency Management Agency Administrator Brock Long said that Irma may have damaged as many as two-thirds of all buildings in the Keys. David Ovalle is a reporter with the Miami Herald. He's been in the Keys and joins us now from Miami. David, tell us what you saw there, including in Cudjoe Key, where Irma came ashore.
The devastation was certainly more pronounced in those areas in Big Torch, Cudjoe, Summerland Key, the areas north of Key West. And it definitely looked like a war zone. You know, there was just the eeriest sight was, as the storm was sort of still subsiding, there's still lots of rain and wind, and we drove up. And there's just in this eerie mist, there's a big, you know, 40-45 foot boat in the middle of the highway as if someone had plucked it from the harbor and just placed it there. And of course, there was a lot of trailers and trailer parks that were overturned and just ripped apart. A lot of gas station canopies crumpled and homes that were damaged. But surprisingly, in some of the neighborhoods we went to, a lot of the homes were still structurally pretty good. I mean, they, you know, obviously got walloped, but there wasn't this widespread flattening like we've seen in Andrew or even in Charlie. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of places that did get extensive damage. But I was surprised that some of the neighborhoods fared relatively well.
What do you think is the reason for that? Are they just homes that were built very well, or is it that the wind was not as much as people thought?
It's probably a little bit of both. The Keys prepares for these types of things. The homes are built specifically with hurricanes in mind. One house we visited and we met with the caretaker there. And the first level, the ground level, is designed to blow out. It's designed to basically withstand storm surge. So they're all on stilts, you know, and that's exactly what happened. The water surge just, you know, blew through the first level, filled up this garage area. And when it subsided, you know, it left all this debris. There was seagrass and the spokes of some bicycles that were there and, you know, crabs and fish and all kinds of stuff. But it kind of worked the way it was supposed to. So it's going to be a long road to recovery, but I think it could have been a lot worse.
Are the Keys all accessible at this point for people who want to go back?
As of right now, no. Only up to about Isla Mirada, which is maybe a quarter of the way down. And that's because they don't have the infrastructure in place to feed them, to give them water, to gas up their generators. So it's more of a thing that they want to make sure they can handle it before they have this sudden influx of people.
But they have said today that the bridges are all safe to drive over.
Yes, they've finally done their surveys and they believe it's safe. But now it's just a matter of getting everything else in place. It's not just people returning to their homes to check on their properties. It's also relatives of people who live down there that are just chomping at the bit, waiting to get down and try to find their family members because there's no cell service and there's a lot of worried relatives out there trying to find their loved ones.
Now, you rode out the storm on Key West. In fact, I was watching your tweets that morning before the eye came to the Keys. And then all of a sudden, your tweets disappeared because you lost communication. But what was it like to be in the storm on Key West? And what does Key West look like at this point?
Key West got walloped pretty good, but it was definitely not as bad as everyone was thinking. I mean, we rode it out in a three-story concrete building. And we fully expected the windows to blow out and that we would all have to huddle in the stairwell and you know, just wait for the worst of the storm to pass. And in the end, it ended up being bad, but everyone was downstairs watching it in the first floor lobby with the clear windows. And so it was bad, but, you know, it's a lot of tree limbs down. A house owned by poet Shel Silverstein got demolished when a big ficus tree fell on it. But in the end, I think Key West got spared the devastation that everyone was fearing.
And Key West, a major tourist destination. When do you think tourists will be going back to Key West?
Not anytime soon. It's going to be months before it's back to where it was. But I will tell you the sort of indomitable Key spirit, you know, the day of the storm as it's still passing and there's still rain and stuff. And toward the tail end of it, there was already a couple bars open. All the street chickens were still out and about. And a lot of the homeless people that just hang out in Duval Street and they love being there, and they're sort of the street characters that are in Key West, they were back on the streets within hours of the storm passing.
What sticks with you from the last few days, the experience you've had being in the Keys during and after Irma?
I think the dread leading up to it was unlike anything I've been in, and I've covered, this is my 16th named storm that I've covered, because it was a Category 5, and because Key West is isolated, it's out there, it's a low-lying island. I mean, we pretty much expected to be, you know, washed out to sea, and that fear, I hadn't seen anything like that. And I was in Katrina in New Orleans, and I've been in Dean, in which is a Category 5 in Mexico. But, I mean, just the fear leading up to it was really bad. I mean, old-time conks that just hightailed it and said, you know what, we're getting out of here. We can't deal with this.
That's David Ovalle, a reporter with the Miami Herald. David, great reporting. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, Hurricanes Harvey and Irma left many communities in Texas and Florida with damaged water and sewage systems and without drinking water and flushable toilets, a sober reminder of the fragility of our infrastructure system. The Trump administration is proposing to invest some $200 billion to upgrade infrastructure, but some critics say the plan does little to address access to safe drinking water in rural communities. Elizabeth Jenkins of Alaska's Energy Desk visited the village of Angoon on Admiralty Island, whose public water system relies on a beaver dam.
Getting to the village of Angoon isn't easy. It's hours away from Alaska's capital city by ferry, or you can take a float plane. And with a population of about 400, there are more brown bears on the island than people. This tight-knit community has to be self-sufficient. And that includes monitoring what comes out of the tap.
This here's where the water comes up from the lake, and it goes up this way to the green pipe.
Paul Thomas shows me around Angoon's water treatment facility, a small rectangular building at the end of a dirt road. Metal pipes snake along the walls. Thomas is an operator here, and his favorite part of the job is removing the crud from the filters.
Getting these cleaned out so that I'm not getting my town sick is just doing this job, I guess, is kind of fulfilling.
Thomas says before he got this job, he didn't pay much attention to where Angoon's water came from. He used to keep a water filtration pitcher in his fridge, but not anymore.
A lot of people here, I see when I go to the store, they're buying water bottles still. So I just tell them, well, hey, I drink it right out of the faucet. It's good. I make the best water in town.
But the best water in town comes at a price, one that Albert Kukesh III, the city clerk, says is growing. We take a walk to Oktaw Lake, Angoon's water source. It's a deep green color and flanked by trees. The thing that's not visible is the natural dam holding it all in, a beaver dam.
You know, it's kind of funny and it's kind of cute in its own way.
But Kukesh says the work that goes into keeping the system running is serious. The water is pumped up from the lake using electricity, which can be expensive since the city runs on diesel. In the winter, the level of the lake can fluctuate, sometimes dramatically, depending on the amount of snow. And there are problems to having a dam created by tiny paws.
So theoretically, if that dam did break, what would happen?
You know, the water level would drop drastically. I don't know if it would all go, but I know that it would drop. You know, that's the million-dollar question.
Kukesh says there are some upgrades that could make Angoon's water system more reliable and affordable. like replacing the Beaver Dam with actual levees. There's also interest in getting solar panels for the treatment facility, but there's just not the money for improvements. Ngun uses a combination of city taxes and a yearly appropriation from the state to pay for water treatment, but it's still difficult for the city to break even. Unemployment is high here, and about 40% of the community can't afford to pay their monthly water bill.
We at the city know that because, you know, we're in the same boat as them.
And when someone can't pay that $50, the city winds up eating the cost. Ukash says he's not sure how much longer that can continue. If nothing changes in 2 or 3 years, Ngun might have to limit around-the-clock running water for everyone.
And, you know, that's something that, you know, we don't want to do in Ngun, but it's something that, you know, we might have to do. Not something fun to think about, especially for somebody that grew up with water and flushing toilets. You know, you want to make sure that that option's always there.
There's a very large need for upgrading some of the older systems around the state, just like Ngun.
That's Bill Griffith, who oversees the Village Safe Water Program at Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation. About 190 small communities can't afford to fix their systems without some kind of help. Griffith says his agency has identified $1.7 billion of water and sewer projects in Alaska that need to be addressed. But every year, it only receives about $60 million in state and federal funding.
It's really just kind of a Band-Aid at this point.
President Trump's budget for next fiscal year proposes zeroing out some of the grant funding for repairing Alaska's outdated systems. And the state itself is having a budget crisis, so it's unlikely to increase any funding. For now, Griffith says Ngun's best bet is to try to upkeep its existing water system. Unlike some other places in Alaska, Ngun actually has running water. That's not the case for about 30 Alaska rural communities. Albert Kukesh III says, at least in the meantime, nature is providing.
You know, the beavers are still there, you know, doing their thing, but it's something that the beavers created and we've definitely taken advantage of.
And Kukesh jokes that beaver hunters aren't welcome in town. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
Officials in San Diego County are working to combat a hepatitis A outbreak amongst the homeless and IV drug users. Cases have been reported in the city and other municipalities across the county. Dr. Wilma Wooten is with the San Diego County Health and Human Services Agency. And Dr. Wooten, first of all, remind us, what is hepatitis A and how is it transmitted?
Hepatitis A is a virus that infects the liver, and it can be transmitted through a foodborne source or through person-to-person contact via the fecal-oral route. So when an individual is infected with the virus, it can cause fever, jaundice, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, feeling very fatigued, diarrhea as well, and dark urine. And this incubation period is about 15 to 50 days, so it's a long incubation period. But when an individual is exposed, usually within 2 to 4 weeks, they can develop symptoms.
Yeah. So I'm seeing that there are nearly 400 reported infected individuals in some of the homeless communities in San Diego. That seems like a lot. So is it possible to stop the outbreak now when there are so many folks who've already been infected?
Well, we're doing everything we can through strategic approaches of vaccination, sanitation, and education to stop this outbreak. We have now up to 421 confirmed or probable cases. 69% of those have been hospitalized, and now we are at 16 deaths.
Oh, wow. So it's very serious then.
It is very serious. This outbreak is being spread through person-to-person contact via the fecal-oral route. If someone's infected, they go to the bathroom, they don't wash their hands, and then they touch objects in the environment, then uninfected people can come along and pick up the virus that way. It only takes really a small dose to spread. So we're vaccinating. We've vaccinated now over 21,000, either the at-risk group of homeless or illicit drug use or individuals associated with the population. We are trying to prevent this from getting into the general community. That's our primary focus.
Well, yeah, so vaccination, an important part of the strategy to stop this outbreak. But I'm also seeing that hand-washing stations have been installed and that San Diego is also doing sanitary street washing, power washing sidewalks and streets with a bleach-based kind of cleaner. How effective has that been, or how effective do you hope it to be?
Well, we hope it will help curtail this outbreak. The city of San Diego is conducting the street cleanings in the city. We've now placed 42 hand washing stations within the boundaries of the city of San Diego, and we'll be doing the same in the other municipalities where we are seeing cases.
Does San Diego have a needle exchange program or any of the other similar type program already in place? Because obviously needles are a primary source of the spread of many diseases.
Yes, the county of San Diego does not, but we are working with all of the facets, homeless service providers, drug treatment service providers, and all organizations that provide meals to the homeless and also provide programs to help with drug use.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Wilma Wooten is the public health officer for the San Diego County Health and Human Services Agency. Dr. Wooten, thank you so very much for your time and your efforts.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions. There goes the last DJ. Love song. Chris Muckley is a DJ with KCRW. He is back with us today from Santa Monica. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing well, and let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is Emily Riley, also known as Birdie Bardot, with Fortune.
You read my fortune. You read my fortune. You read my fortune and got it wrong. Dark days were all behind me. You read my fortune and got it wrong. Got it wrong. I have been tortured. Yes, I've been tortured.
Now, Emily Riley says she is heavily influenced by 60s era rock and Nancy Sinatra, which I totally hear there in that.
Yeah, actually, I actually hear a lot of kind of PJ Harvey meets The Kills in that particular song. That's actually one of my favorite things about this band is that, like I said, while that song kind of lives in a PJ Harvey world, some of the other music on this record goes into like a folk place or even there's some dream pop. In fact, there was a great song on her last record that I used to play a bit that was quite different from this song. Birdie Bardot is a band from San Diego, as you mentioned. Her name is Emily Riley. She's the creative force. And then her band is essentially collaborations of other musicians from San Diego bands, as that's where they're based.
And what do you like about this song, Fortune?
It's kind of dark and it's kind of moody, but at the same time, I still think it has a really good energy. And it made me, when I was first listening to the album and I got through that one, I immediately stopped and listened to it two more times in a row before I continued with the record. So it just really caught my attention.
All right. Well, next, we are staying with the retro vibe. This is New Orleans native The Dream Rebel with the single Hurt Me Bad.
Yeah.
lot of energy in this. What do you make of this one?
You know, this is a brand new discovery to me, and I would say this is the one with the most mystery that I'm bringing to the table, because I don't know much about him. I know what you just said, that he's, you know, a musician from New Orleans. He goes by the Dream Rebel, and it doesn't seem like he wants his real name out there. I haven't found it on anything yet. So I didn't probe it further. I just think that's how this guy wants to be known. This song, Hurt Me Bad, is the first that we've heard from a forthcoming EP. It'll be out in fall. And, you know, I just think it's an immediate earworm. There's, as you said, a lot of kind of retro, particularly British influence in this song. T-Rex, Bowie, there's a part that sounds like Freddie Mercury just pipes in for a couple seconds. So I think this guy is one to keep our eyes on.
All right, well, let's get next to some rhythm and blues with Sun Little of Philadelphia. Here's his song, Blue Magic, Waikiki.
I got blue. So tragic, probably 44 moons or more. And I don't want to count how many days I've been dragged all around the floor. And I don't want to be a bad man, but I'm a bad man just the same. You know, we got no time for games.
Yeah.
I got the blue magic, and I rock you so savage, cause I got the blue magic.
I think I had a Blue Magic when I was in Waikiki. It was very tasty.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it turn your tongue blue?
Yeah, I think it must have turned my tongue blue. What should we know about this?
This is, Sun Little, who is a guy from Philly. His name is Aaron Livingston, and it's definitely not the first that we've heard from him. He put out an EP and an album previously, but this new record will be called New Magic. It's got kind of a relaxed, romantic vibe, and it's, you know, just kind of about the magic of summer.
And it could be more Hawaiian, but it's got a little bit of that. I see what you're saying about the magic of summer and the sound of summer. It does have a little bit of a tropical feel to it.
Yeah, it does. And you're right. It's not overly tropical, but I think even knowing that the word Waikiki is, you know, in
right.
the title, it kind of puts you there already. And then just kind of the mellow, happy vibes of the song just make you feel like you're kind of taking a vacation in your head.
All right. Well, the next song that you brought us is sort of a black sheep in this group, but it's somebody that everybody knows, Randy Newman. Here's the song, Putin.
Me is just like a regular fella. There ain't nothing like a regular fella. Putin his hat on, hat size number 9. You say Putin's getting big headed? Putin says just fine. He can drive his giant tractor across the Trans-Siberian Plain. He can power a nuclear reactor with the left side of his brain. When he take his shirt off, he drive a lady's crazy. When he take his shirt off, make me want to be a lady. It's the Putin girls.
Maybe they're going to play this at the Nationals game like they play I Love L.A. from Randy Newman at the Dodgers games.
Like
I don't know.
His new anthem, yeah. You know, Randy Newman is nothing short of a living legend. He's been putting out music for a good half century. He's an award-winning film composer. This new record, Dark Matter, is his first in 9 years, and the humor and the satire that he's so well known for, it's all right there. And what I personally love about this song, Putin, is that it just makes Vladimir Putin into even more of a cartoon character than he already has become through other satirical outlets such as SNL, you know, where he's always portrayed with his shirt off. And you heard Randy singing about Putin taking his shirt off, you
right.
know. It's like he fancies himself as this God's gift to humanity. And, you know, it's strangely timely, particularly because Randy Newman says that he actually wrote this song long before the whole 2016 election and all the scandal that has ensued in the days since.
Well, and he doesn't mention President Trump in the song. I guess that explains it.
No, but I'll tell you what, it's really the musicians who are really going after all of these characters, you know. It's funny how the news media will call Trump a liar now, but that took a long time. But musicians, it's like they haven't been having any of it from the beginning.
Well, we have time for one more song. This is Night, performed by Jonathan Rado.
Get up every morning at the sound of the bell. To
Bruce Springsteen fans would recognize this as a cover.
Yes, there's a website called Turntable Kitchen, and they have a project called Sounds Delicious, where they basically task a current artist with covering an entire classic album. And Jonathan Rado, who is one half of the band Foxygen and who has also become a really go-to producer in the indie world, he chose to cover Born to Run in its entirety. And, you know, a lot of the songs on this album are very true to the originals, but this particular one, I really feel like he put a creative spin on, particularly in the way that he plays with the tempo of the song. He speeds it up at certain points in a really distinct manner. And in the original version, I think Bruce does this a little bit, but it's much more pronounced in Jonathan Rado's version. So I feel like he, you know, took this classic Bruce album cut and turned it into an awesome little indie rock number.
Well, that's where we will leave it this week. Chris Muckley, DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Scientists have found strong evidence that bacteria in the human gut might play a role in multiple sclerosis, an incurable autoimmune disease. Two new studies add a growing body of evidence that show some kind of link between MS and the microbiome. Joining us with more on this research is Sharon Begley, who's a science writer for our partners at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication. Sharon, it's good to talk with you again.
You too, Meghna.
Well, first of all, can you explain to me what is it about multiple sclerosis that even prompted scientists to look into whether or not sort of the gut microbiome is even connected to the disease?
Well, in general, the microbiome is very hot. It's been connected to diseases as diverse as, gosh, schizophrenia and obesity and everything in between. But, you know, more substantively, research has been accumulating that there might be something different about the gut bacteria in people with the disease compared to people without it. So this is a very robust line of research over the last few years.
Okay, interesting. So tell us then a little bit more. I mean, how substantially different is the gut bacteria between people with and without the disease then?
Right. So the studies that had been done before the couple that we're talking about this week had shown that, indeed, there are different species of bacteria in people with multiple sclerosis compared to people who do not have the disease. But whenever you have a finding like that, the question, of course, is which came first?
Exactly.
Which is the chicken? Which is the egg? So what the two new studies did is go beyond that, and they tried to establish that, indeed, something about these gut bacteria are causing or at least contributing to MS.
Oh, really? So they were able to determine that or get closer to that determination?
Definitely closer. And what they did was take the microbiomes from people with the disease and they mixed it up with blood, normal, healthy blood. And they found that the bacteria from the patients were triggering changes in the blood, basically causing the immune system cells, T cells, to become more inflammatory, more of the kind that will attack the body. And that, of course, is what MS is, right? Your own immune system is attacking your neurons. Conversely, bacteria from healthy people did not have that response. And then there was a companion study in which the bacteria from people with MS were transplanted into mice. And in that case, the mice developed a form of MS, a mouse form of MS, whereas people without MS, when their bacteria were transplanted into the mice, the rodents were absolutely fine. So again, it's not a slam dunk. It's not a lock, but at least we're getting a little bit closer to showing that indeed the microbes in the gut might have something to do with increasing your risk of getting MS.
This sounds actually quite remarkable to me, Sharon.
It's pretty neat. And, you know, it does sound crazy, but indeed all the explosion of research in the microbiome has shown that it absolutely does interact with the immune system. And again, the immune system is key to MS. And where it's so interesting, of course, is that there has also been companion research showing how you can alter the microbiome, how you can encourage some species and, you know, quash others. And if you can do that with probiotics or even diet or fecal transplants, which is an established treatment for a particular bacterial infection called C. difficile. You know what? The treatments that we have for MS now are not very good, and there certainly is not a cure. So this is a new avenue of research. A lot more studies have to be done, but it's, you know, it's intriguing and it's even promising.
So definitely an exciting new pathway, as you said, for research and possibly, you know, even down the line, the development of new therapies. But I guess I should have asked you a little earlier, Sharon. Now, are the microbiome that was in the gut of the MS sufferers, was it one or two different species? I mean, how narrowly focused are the bacteria that we're talking about here?
The researchers identified two, one level above species called a genus, which was way more common in people with MS. They are not household names. They're called Acinetobacteria and Akkermansia bacteria. And they emerged as the two that seemed to be just stand out different in people with the disease compared to healthy people. And those were the two kinds of bacteria which activated immune attack in the blood and decreased the kind of immune cells that suppress autoimmunity.
Can we know how those bacteria or those particular microbes even got into the gut microbiome of the folks suffering from MS?
So that remains a mystery. All of us have not unique microbiomes, but characteristic of where we live, what we eat, and who we live with, and even how we were born, you know, going back to our first hour on this planet. And it can be changed. What you eat can affect the kinds of bacteria that thrive in your gut and the kind that's a sort of die off. So there's a great deal still to be learned. It's not that these bacteria are always bad, but something about them combined, probably with other things, there might be genetic factors, are causing some people, it seems, to develop multiple sclerosis.
Well, it seems like very exciting steps taken forward there in our understanding of MS. Sharon Begley, senior science writer for our partners at STAT, thank you so very much for bringing this research to us.
Thank you, Meghna.
And later today on All Things Considered, NPR's Kelly McEvers speaks with director Angelina Jolie about her new film, First They Killed My Father. It's about the brutal Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.